Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My topic is really to respond to many suggestions that machines, that AI can become conscious. That's something you very often hear, and why should we not believe that? Do we have good reasons not to believe that? Or maybe we should ask the other way. Do we have reasons to believe this? And the question is not entirely new, even though these technologies are new. There are in history some antecedents. I mean, just think of Frankenstein's monster. You build a machine, you know, can it have consciousness just because you inject it with electricity? We have the stories of Pygmalion and Pinocchio and things like that. Or the golem in the Jewish tradition, made out of clay, and then people put the name of God on a piece of paper into the mouth of that clay figure, which is a little bit like Adam and God breathing into Adam, right, into the nostrils of Adam, and being made in the image and likeness of God for that reason. But can we do that, or is that something only God can do? These are real questions. In the Halakha, they even discussed whether Golem should be treated like a human person. And we have just these questions again today, people thinking of robot rights and things like that. Now, some of our intuitions will clearly tell us that that is not so. For example, have you ever felt tempted to apologize to your computer? Probably, yes. Well, our intuitions are shifting, I guess, but have you ever considered telling your computer a joke? Probably not. You know, I mean, so you don't think there is someone there to appreciate it, right? So, I mean, there's some, our intuitions still go that way. And Alan Turing, who was mentioned earlier, who argues on the other side of things, still quotes a number of these intuitions, and there's a whole list of them, and I'll read this to you and find that some of them are already not intuitive anymore. So here's this list, you know. Here's what computers cannot do. Be kind, resourceful, beautiful, friendly, have initiative, have a sense of humor, tell right from wrong, make mistakes, fall in love, enjoy strawberries and cream, make someone fall in love with it, learn from experience, use words properly, be the subject of its own thought, have as much diversity of behavior as a man, do something really new. So some of these things, and we will talk about that, I think are still right and intuitively true, but there are others that we think they can do. I mean, just to putting words in a proper order, for example, or even make one fall in love with it. Now, that's the newest thing that's going to come this year, actually, if you've not heard about it. So this will be a huge mess, too. We can talk about that in a later session. But so these are some of these intuitions. I think we still think that we don't feel guilty if we turn off our computer at night. We don't think we have just murdered it, right? And this is actually a rather important point, because we would feel like that if we turn off a human being or even a dog. You know, their little toy dogs, AI toy dogs now to entertain the elderly and so forth. Well, they're very handy because, you know, at night, I mean, first of all, you don't have to take them out for making their things, and they also don't ruin your furniture, and when at night, if they're bothersome, you can just turn them off. Tomorrow is another day, and we'll turn them on again. You cannot do that with a real dog. Forget about intelligent beings, just animals, right? How about plants? If you kill a plant, the plant is dead. You cannot bring it back to life. That's very important because, and I would like to argue in many ways, if we have enough time, that our body, our biology actually does matter. We have talked a lot about intellect and will, but they have a location in a body. And the question is, what is a suitable body? We are not angels. So we do have a body. These things do require a location in the material world. And that is what we share, for example, with computers. But the computers don't have a body like ours. They don't have a living body. They have a body that you can turn on and off again. A living body is not, that's not in our control. We cannot give life. And that's very important, I mean, for our intuitions. If we cannot even make the life of a plant, why do we think we can make conscious life? Conscious life, let alone rational life. This is a higher form of life. I don't think we have any reason to think that. And I think, so I want to shift our intuitions a little bit by pointing out these things and also to shift the burden of proof. You know, who has to prove whether computers have consciousness or not? If we see these kind of things, I think clearly the burden of proof moves to the other side. And there are more reasons for that, which I'll go through. It is also important to notice that our intuitions can be fooled if we think that intelligence has to do just with behavior or performance. Professor Wales quoted a number of thinkers who reduce that to that. I mean, Harari and others. Turing, too. It's not just a matter of external behavior. That could be just metaphorical intelligence, as Father James said. It appears like that. It is a simulation of it, but that is not the real thing. Now, we have become very good at making these simulations. When I grew up, my sister had a motion-activated doll. So if you turned it over, it said, Mama. And, you know, why? What reason do we have to think that these machines and the robots that we can build with them are not just much more sophisticated motion-activated dolls? It's not in principle different. It's just a matter of difference in sophistication, but there's nothing more there. In fact, they may even outperform us. They do it all the time. That doesn't make them more persons than we are. My car can go faster than I can go. That doesn't make it more of a person, right? My computer can calculate much faster than I can. Doesn't make it more of a person. Performance is not the criterion. In the reverse, we think that a human embryo in the womb of its mother is a person with a rational soul, an immortal soul. It cannot perform any of the things that your machine or your laptop can do. That doesn't make it less of a person. The reality is something very different from the outward performance or what it can do. There's a difference between being and doing here, and that's a very important one. We may think that if we just make a simulation that is really, really, really good, then it becomes the real thing, right? But I think that's also a bit of a fallacy. A really, really, really good simulation is, for that matter, more of a simulation because it's a very good simulation. It does not, because of that, become the real thing. If you make really, really, really good counterfeit money, it doesn't become real money, and you still go to jail for it. So simulation and reality remain different, and we have to keep that separate in our minds. One of the reasons that we may think that computers can have consciousness too is because in recent history, we have started to think about ourselves on the model of machines. That our bodies, our brains are precisely that. They are material instantiations of something similar that is maybe just, you know, a carbon-based computer. rather than silicon. You know, your brain does that just in a different material substratum. And so that's all that there is about is our thought is just our neurons firing and there is nothing more to it. If we think that that is all that there is to us and to our thoughts and our minds and to our life, then the leap isn't very far to say if you produce a machine like that, well, then it must be conscious too. And so again, I want to shift the burden of proof by just showing how that is impossible to assume about ourselves. And I'll point out the implications for AI and merely material things as we go along. But in the case of machines, we do not need to assume any kind of consciousness. We know how they work. We have made them. There is no mystery to that. The material configurations are perfectly sufficient to explain their behavior. We do know that that is not true for us. We cannot explain everything about ourselves by merely material states. And that is now what I'm going to go through in a number of ways. And the first one, and I'm a little bit working up the the scale from Father James's kind of chart, if you remember that. I said a little bit about the vegetative things. I'm not going to go into that much otherwise. But let's just talk about animal subjectivity, animal consciousness, right? So we don't even have to talk about intelligence yet. Let's just talk about consciousness. And among those things, I'll outline three features, and I take that from John Searle, a contemporary analytical philosopher, but I think it does line up also with what Thomas Aquinas would say. And the first one of that are these qualia that someone of you mentioned earlier, the qualitative states of the mind. These are what we're talking about here are how it feels like to experience certain kinds of things, how it is like to be in that state. The way heat and cold feel, sense of touch. The way red looks to our eyesight. The way a rose smells. The way the coffee tastes or the clarinet sounds. These are qualitative states. There's a way in which it feels to be like that or in that state. There's also a way in which it feels to be like to be in pain, for example. So all qualitative states. Now, where are these qualitative states in matter? Where are they in the brain? If I see something blue and a neurophysiologist would look at my brain, would he see something there turning blue? Hardly. You know? If I drink coffee, would my brain start to smell like coffee? Someone who has talked a lot about that is Thomas Nagel, the philosopher, and he suggests, you know, if you eat chocolate ice cream and your scientist would lick at your brain, it wouldn't taste like chocolate. It is nowhere in the material states of the brain. It also wouldn't change if you use really, really good microscopes. It's not because it's hiding there on a microscopic level. It's not that there could be something discovered. There's no little screen in our brain that suddenly shows what we are conscious of. None of these things can be material, because if they were material, we would discover them in that way. I mean, just better microscopes or whatever it is. So, which leads me to say that in some way they must be immaterial. Now, here the question from the earlier question comes up with the qualia, you know. Do animals have immortal souls, therefore? No, as Father James pointed out, I mean, all sensations are about particulars. And we have sense organs that go with that. So we have eyes, we have ears, you know, we have a nose and things like that. These are tied to the material embodiment, I mean, our body in which they are located, and therefore they cannot survive without it. So there is more than matter, but it is still tied to matter in a way. So that would be true for animals. These material states are subjective, and I mean, so they're, you cannot see them looking at my brain, which means I know them, but you don't. At least not by looking at my brain. And you don't know how it feels like for me to have these sensations. I can access them directly. I cannot be wrong about them either. If I see something blue, I see something blue, even if it's a hallucination, right? But you cannot know that. So this is kind of a difference also that opens up here, which doesn't have any analog in the material world. Okay, I leave that there. So that's sort of the lowest level of conscious life, you know, animal life, and we share that with animals. Another feature is what I will call, with John Searle, the unified field of consciousness. And Thomas Aquinas talks about that too, and Professor Wales talked about how our mind is unified in contemplation at the end of days. But it is actually something that happens really from the bottom up. So if you just think about what you, all the things you are aware of right now in this room, right? There are many things, and you're just talking about the visual field, but you can also include the acoustic kind of things, anything else that goes on in this room. There are many of these, but they're all part of your one consciousness. You are conscious of them, they're part of your consciousness, and you are aware of them to various degrees at the same time. Your mind unifies all these many things that you are aware of. Mind is a unifier in that sense. But the things that you are aware of are not out there unified in that way. So I'm aware of all of you, but you're still different rational substances, individual substances of a rational nature, right? You're not becoming one blob of things. So the unification is in my mind, it's not in the external world. So where then in me is it? Is it in my brain? If you look at my brain, again, you will find nothing like that. There's no little screen there or something that unifies it. You will find neurons firing, perhaps in different kind of patterns and so forth. But what unifies these firing neurons? Except for maybe the neurophysiologist that looks at it at the same time, which is, again, another mind. The brain is not in the same sense unified. And so people found that there are different separate specializing neurons that are responsible for different aspects, like the angles of things, the color of things, the shape of things. And yet, they all become the consciousness of one thing. What binds these different neurons together and their activity? That's what's sometimes called the binding problem. So this is a feature of consciousness, again, that has no material correlate. You cannot find it in your brain or anywhere else, let alone in a machine. These things happen all the time. I mean, if you listen to a melody, right? A melody is something that binds together many notes into one. And the notes sound different depending on the other notes that are there. They form a whole, there's a kind of a gestalt to that. There are many of these unified kind of things that are only unified in our mind, though, and so not out in the world. So that's what I call the unified field of consciousness, again, with John Searle. And that is also something that again, as I said, Thomas Aquinas mentions it. The philosopher Leibniz mentions that. Again, as I said, there are earlier thinkers talking about that, and he's arguing against Thomas Hobbes. You know, Thomas Hobbes thought that our mind is just like a machine, is the brain, basically. There's nothing else to it. And Leibniz said, well, if you think that, we should be, by thought experiment, able to enlarge that brain so that we can walk into it, like into a windmill, he says. And what all that we would see is wheels turning and so forth, but we wouldn't see a single perception. We wouldn't see anything that unifies things in such a way that as consciousness does. So that's basically that same point. Thirdly, intentionality. Intentionality is what people call the aboutness of our mind. So consciousness, as phenomenologists say, consciousness is always the consciousness of something. I love something, I doubt something, I know something, I imagine something, I smell something. It's all about something. Consciousness about nothing is unconsciousness, basically. It's a basic feature of consciousness that it is about something. Now, if we look at the physical world, we can take the typical example of billiard balls. It's always an example people like to use, billiard balls running across the billiard table. And one billiard ball can bounce into another, and so forth. But B is not suddenly saying, ouch, or, ah, there must be an A around that affects me in this kind of way. In other words, it is not aware of the billiard ball A bouncing into it. It's not conscious of it, right? Because these are merely physical things. Just one mechanical cause after another, the efficient causality. If, now we say, we give B or C consciousness, what happens? It becomes aware of A. That awareness goes in that direction. It is not your physical causality. It's not an instance of physical causality. It is that's what we call intentionality, the awareness of. But it does require both of these arrows. So if we think of ourselves, if I'm seeing something, there is physical causality going on. It's not enough to explain that, but it is going on because light waves bounce off physical objects and come to hit my retina, right? That's basically what the billiard balls do. But based on that, I become also aware of that from which the light waves bounce off. But that is more than just what happens physically. Nothing physical corresponds to my awareness of these objects. If that were otherwise, right, the good detection device would make you aware if I think of you or see you or something like that, because there would be then another causality coming from my mind at you, and that is not the case. These are in itself non-physical forms of relations. So it's that kind of awareness of, which cannot be explained physically or by any physical processes in the brain. And that is therefore what also material things don't have. As somebody has said, you know, one chunk of matter doesn't fall in love with another chunk of matter, which is an intentional state of mind. There's more to that. So if you understand that, there are a number of things that follow from that. For example, if my awareness, my intentionality, my intentional awareness of the rest of the world is again tied to my body and happens in and through my body. And not just the brain. What I see depends also what I do with my whole body, how I move my head and things like that. People talk about embodied cognition that way. And if I touch something, if I touch this desk, this embo, then where does that touch happen? Do I feel it in my brain? No, I feel it in my fingertips. Right? It is my whole body that is part of my awareness of things. It is sort of as if my awareness, if my consciousness colonizes my whole physical body and spreads over it, as somebody has said, like a blush. Now, computers don't blush, right? They don't have a living body. That my intentionality, my agency, my intention, I mean, or my awareness of, if that is embodied in my whole body, that means I have a living body. And again, we come back to life in that case. We cannot make such bodies, and our computers are not such bodies. They are merely mechanical devices that are not alive. And so you do need a living body for a human rational mind that inhabits a body, if you want. Inhabiting is probably not the right word even. Now, the interesting thing is we do nevertheless talk about our machines in that way. We talk about robots seeking things or monitoring things, trying out things, taking things to be the case. We talk about heat-seeking missiles. Right? What does it mean for a missile to seek heat? It sounds like an intentional kind of thing. So intentionality, by the way, is not just a practical intentionality. That's the English language tends to think that way. It's also theoretical awareness of. But nevertheless, it can seek things too, and that's an intention form of intentionality. Does the missile actually do that? We can say that a computer detects key presses. It tries to initialize printers. It searches for available devices. A thermostat can monitor the room temperature. So all intentional states, if you want, and we talk that way. And you could put ice next to the thermostat, and then it mistakes the room temperature, right? You can fool it. Now remember, Turing said, cannot make mistakes. He understood that difference because, again, they don't literally have states of intentionality. We talk about computers that way because they are our tools. They externally embody our intentions. They don't have intentions of their own. These are our intentions. We seek heat by the missile and in order to destroy something. We are looking for the printers to use them. It's not the machine itself. It's kind of a projection on our mind. And hence, you can say again, they're metaphorically intentional. And they simulate it in a certain kind of way. Daniel Dennett calls that the intentional stance. So if we take the intentional stance towards machines or other entities, we read them, so to speak, as if they had intentions or were pursuing things. They don't literally do that. Now, Daniel Dennett was a materialist and an atheist and so forth, and what he wanted to say is that that is true for us as well. We just read ourselves as if we were intentional, but we actually don't have intentionality either because that's not a material kind of feature. Well, but who is doing the reading here? Reading something, taking a stance, is itself a form of intentionality. And so either we have it or it never happens. You cannot give what you don't have. Or maybe somebody else reads us as intentional, maybe God or something, but that also is certainly not something an atheist or materialist would envision. But it's also not necessary because that is what our minds do intrinsically. You don't have to go beyond that. The mind just is imbued with that kind of intentionality. Now, this intentionality is something we share with animals. You don't have to have a rational mind to do that. Animals, indeed, seek things. A lion goes to stalk its prey, you know, and is, as Aquinas would say, it's the imagination that anticipates that. That prey, but it is looking for the prey, and it is not actually there yet. Right? So you have something in mind that you pursue, but it is absent. That's why you're looking for it. But it is something you have in mind. So it is in some way present to you while it is absent. It is the presence of an absence. And these kind of absential features, as somebody has said, these are very curious forms of negativity, absence, non-being, not being there. And these, by definition, cannot be material states. Material things are there. They are not absent. You know? Absence is not a material thing. So how do they enter into the world if everything is material? And that happens in a number of ways. So, as I said, I mean, an animal pursues a prey if or fruit or whatever that it doesn't see yet. It's not present yet. That's future-directed. It's the presence of something that is not present yet. It can be also states that are about something that is not anymore, That is what we call memory, which is another state of intentionality. I remember something, and I remember something that is not here yet and now. There's a notness, like there's a presence of an absence. This negativity, this absence is not something material. Now that's very interesting, though, because we talk about our computers having memory, right? Well, literally speaking, nothing, there is no memory in our computers. I'm trying to scandalize you a little bit here, and that there were more things to come. So there's not literally any memory in your computer. We read certain physical states of the computer as the memory of something else, but it's not something that's literally in your computer. We take this intentional stance. We interpret it to mean something that's not there. But that is not literally in a material state of the computer. I think I skipped that part. Here's another interesting aspect of that. If you know the rule that double minus makes, or double negative makes positive, right? Interestingly, the opposite is not the case. A double positive doesn't make a negative. You know, why might that be? Well, it is based on what I just said. That's easy to understand, because if our mind introduces negativity in the world, or the possibility of something being absent, then the negation of that would mean now it's there. So the gazelle is not present to the lion when it looks for it, but then it is there, and you negate the absence of the gazelle. Right? And so you have a double negative, and that makes for a positive. But that doesn't work in the opposite way. So you may have all sorts of positive states of matter. You know, matter is always there. And adding up more of that will not lead you to this kind of negativity. So you cannot materialistically explain absence or negativity, but you can, from the mind, talk about matter. So somebody who believes in the existence of mind can explain materialism, but not the other way around. One more feature of this kind of intentionality has to do with this aboutness. So our mind is about something, whether it's about the prey I'm looking for, whether it's about something I remember, something I desire, something I think about. And I can take that aboutness and put it in material form. What do we call that? Language. Right? So I can talk about things and share my mind with you by putting it in physical things that you can perceive, hear, and see. Now, that kind of language typically is such that you have to learn it. Right? So if I don't know Japanese, I haven't learned it, so I will not understand if you do that. You know, my mind, I don't have to learn. I don't have to learn. If I could look into your mind, I wouldn't have to learn anything either. We share that. The mind is transparent to what it means. But the physical signifiers that we use, Aristotle says, are manifold and they're different languages. And they mean what they mean only because we have agreed to that. And so we have to know what we agree upon to know what our language means, whether it's English or Japanese or Korean or whatever else it is. So I have to learn it. So I have to learn in which sense language is about something, in the same way that my mind is about something. And this aboutness is what we call semantics. Certain words refer to things in the world because they participate in or parasitic on what I mean by them. My mind is important. Aristotle says that. And that means if I want to understand a word that you are using, I have to trace that in some way. I have to find the meaning, the aboutness of that term. Now, there's a famous thought experiment by John Searle, the Chinese room argument. Maybe you have heard about that. Who of you has heard about it? Okay, that's a good number. But for those who don't, let me just briefly say it. So it's pretty simple. I mean, you mentioned you are in a room and there are two slits on both sides, and you have a board. And based on that board, so somebody is sliding a Chinese character in to your room, and you look at the board and match it to say a word in Polish. And let's say you don't know what Polish is. You know, don't know either language, right? So. But based on that board, you can match them and appropriately put out a phrase on the other side, the slit, and so forth. Now, do you understand Chinese now? Or Polish, for that matter? Nothing at all. Do you need to understand it? No, it just works just fine without you knowing. It's semantics, right? You don't have to know what it is about. You may slide something through and people laugh on the other side. And, you know, I passed a joke through. You know, but you wouldn't have been able to tell that just by looking at these symbols and signifiers. Now, this is a completely mechanical kind of procedure for me to do. And it is something a machine can do. And the machine, just as little, needs to understand what it is doing. And so translation algorithms will do precisely that. Now, there are different kinds now, and now they work with neural networks, but it's basically the same. I mean, it's just predicting the next word, you know, for like an autocomplete kind of system. Whatever the mechanism is, you don't need to understand anything. You don't need to understand what anybody has in mind by these signifiers. It's possible to do that without that. And indeed, it would take a mind to understand that, and there's no reason to assume that a computer has such a mind, because it doesn't even need it. Which leads to the other scandalous kind of thing, because it means there's literally no information in your computer. Because information is information about something, right? It has precisely these kind of features. There's nothing in the computer that means something and therefore cannot inform you about something unless you take it to mean something, just in the way as you would learn a piece of language or language you haven't known before. In that sense, you may talk about computer language or something like that, but it is language only for us. It's not literally in the computer, and therefore literally there is no information in the computer. And so all of that would be even true for animals. Now, animals don't have language. I wouldn't want to claim that. But they are aware of things, and there is some way for them to be in the world. That means they are conscious of things, they pursue things, and so forth. What typically goes beyond that, so the spiritual faculties of the soul that we talked about earlier, has to do with rational thought. And rational thought is universal thought. By the way, I'm sorry to throw all of this at you after the lunch break. I'm sure that's not easy. But it is universal thought. So just talked about language. You know, so if I use the word dog, for you to understand the word dog means to understand the universal concept of doghood, dogness. It's not for you to think of Fifi or Rix or Fido or whoever else, you know, it is whatever else. It is dogness as such. It is not for you to relate to all the dogs in the world. I mean, not even all the actual dogs or from the past or the future, even all the dogs that never exist, all the dogs in the possible world. This concept covers all of them. You are not related to possible dogs by physical causality, and yet you think of them. So this takes you in a much wider kind of field of your awareness, and it is a field of universality. And we encounter that universality in all sorts of things. So dogs is just one example. Laws of nature are universal too. So they cover all the instances in the known world, and so they are universal in that sense. Laws of logic. Laws of mathematics, geometry. So a circle, right? So the concept of a circle. I can try to draw a circle. Is that a circle? Not really, but Now let's assume I can draw a really, really, really good circle, right? Is that sufficient to represent a circle? No, because it would still be one particular circle. How many circles are there that I would have to draw to cover all the possibilities? Infinitely many, right? There are infinitely many diameters of circles, and so no image that I have in my mind of circles, no image I draw on the board covers all these circles. And yet, I know precisely what I mean whenever I think of a circle. I don't have to say, oh, all these kind of things, maybe all of that is a circle. No, it's quite clear what it is. In the imagination, it would be pretty unclear. But as a thought, it is quite precise. René Descartes' example is not bad. He says you can imagine a triangle and a circle, perhaps, but even that, I think, would not be true. What about a chiliagon, a thing with 1,000 corners? That would be really hard to draw. It is basically impossible to imagine, right? And so if you would try to think of a chiliagon in that way, you would never have a clear idea of it. And you know, nevertheless, precisely we know what we mean by it, because it's not an image, it is a concept. It's a universal concept. But all of that means that there is no adequate material representation of that, no sensual representation. You must leave the realm of materiality to have a clear grasp of what it means. Even if you open your skull and you look at your brain, even if something is written there that says dog or circle, right? It doesn't mean that that this is the thought of dogness or circlehood or something like that. Whatever it is, if it were in your brain, then it would be a material thing in your brain, and it would, by that very fact, be a particular thing. Every material thing is a particular thing. That means it cannot be this identical with the thought of something universal, right? And if that is so, and that's the reason why Aristotle and Aquinas would say your brain cannot be the organ of thought. It is a spiritual faculty for that reason. It's immaterial. That's also the part that indicates to you that you can survive your physical death. You know, that has to do ultimately with the immortality of the soul as well. But it is something we know just from our ordinary thoughts, even if dogs or circles or whatever it might be. We may think that perhaps, it's some kind of pattern that repeats in your brain, right? A recurrence of a certain pattern of firing neurons in your brain. And maybe that recurrence is always the same, this universally repeating pattern, is what we call universality, and maybe that could be a material way of thinking of that. However, for whom or for what is that a recurrence? Not for the brain. Each firing pattern is just that, a particular firing pattern. For that to be one universal recurrence, I mean, you would have to keep it over time. Over time in mind, you need a mind yet again to do that, right? And a mind that in some way transcends matter and time. And even then it wouldn't even amount to a universal, it would be just like drawing a whole lot of circles, but it's still not the same as circlehood. So none of that gets you to universality. Anything material that you may imagine here, be it neurons firing or silicon chips, you know, emitting signals, none of that is universal. How much time do I actually have?
Maybe 5-7 minutes. And that.
Really? Okay, well, then I'm hurrying up here. Just quickly to say, some among these universals are algorithms. Now, algorithms are things that govern sort of performance of computers and so forth, but they're universal kind of things that always would start something in the same way and do something in the same way. But if what I said is true, there are no algorithms in your computer. So just to scandalize you a little further. Algorithms cannot literally be anything physical. And let's come back to that question and answer here if you're interested. That would take me too long probably, because there's one more point I want to get to here. So among the very universal thoughts that we might have, certainly thoughts about mathematics and unity, one, so forth, is a basic concept of mathematics. But that is at the same time also a very simple thought. And here's another question. Can something simple be instantiated in matter? One is not, I mean, so if you look at extended things by their nature are divisible. A unit is precisely that which you cannot divide anymore. You can count the parts into which you divide it, but for that you also have to presuppose already a notion of oneness or unity by which you count one part after another. Right? There's some sense of oneness that you presuppose, and St. Augustine talks about that. And you cannot get that, he says, from matter, because anything material is extended, has parts, and so forth. It is too simple to be material. So that's... And that, again, is something that the thought of the rational mind would have. There are also thoughts that are universal in an unrestricted sense. And here is where something interesting occurs. The thought of everything. You can think of everything, the thought of everything. Now, this thought has the interesting feature that it includes itself. Right? The thought of everything is itself one of everything. It is a thing, after all. Right? So how can a thought include itself? Well, in a thought, obviously, I mean, we think that thought, that seems to be something thoughts can do. And it's a part of the spirituality of our mind that it can do these things. There is no equivalent to that in the physical world. So a physical thing cannot contain itself. It would be, as somebody has said, if you try to put a briefcase into itself. What would that even mean? How would you do that? It doesn't work. No? But you can put a thought into itself. Now this kind of reflexivity of thoughts that are self-including is something that we also do when we say I to ourselves. And that is something we can do as persons. We have self-consciousness. We are aware of ourselves, and if I think the thought I, in some way I combine the simplicity of one that I mentioned earlier and the reflexivity of what I said about everything. So I think of myself as a whole. And it may include a lot of things I don't even know of, you know, what's going on in my liver right now or something. It is an all-encompassing thought. It is part itself of what it thinks, because my thought is part of me, right? And it is also simple. I is a very simple thought. That is why, just by itself, all of us can say I to ourselves, and we always mean in some way the same and not the same at the same time. It's very simple, and it's so simple that it is something that Alzheimer's patients also don't lose. They can still say I to themselves, even if they don't remember who they've been in their life. It is because it is simple. And yet, it is also all-encompassing. We can mean ourselves without knowing all the things we mean, including our lost past or something like that. Again, these are features that you cannot find in any material thing. In material things, one part of a computer can act on another part. That's not the same as reflexivity. That is just, you know, taking one part and putting it in contact with another part. Take an example that Therese Curry likes to use. You can do that with a material thing, and you can fold it on each other, and then one part can manipulate each other. Can set off something else, you know. But if it were to refer to itself in the way that we refer to ourselves, each part needs to touch each other part. How often do I have to fold this to get to that result? To get to the simple thought of myself as a material equivalent. How often do I have to do that? Infinitely many times. And what do you get as a result? Something that's not extended. It's a point, it's a geometrical point, and a geometrical point doesn't have extension. Something that's not extended is not material, as I said earlier, right? So this kind of simplicity that's also involved in the thought of myself even cannot be material. A computer cannot have self-consciousness. So Richard Dawkins and others like to say, well, you talk about Gardner case, but let's say, well, if our computers just get complex enough, then they will have self-consciousness too. That's, of course, getting it totally backward. Self-consciousness is not a feature of complexity. It's a thing of simplicity. It's the simplicity that eludes the possibility of being materially instantiated. You need a rational mind to do that. And we have such a mind. We cannot make simplicity. We can make material things, configure them in all sorts of things, and making them as complex as we want, but that simplicity eludes us. And that is, I want to suggest, I didn't even complete my list here, but that's also at the root of the unified field of consciousness. It is basically the awareness of this unified field of consciousness. So you can play with that. But it is kind of a thing that is simple and yet unifying other things. And that is where, I mean, that would take a little longer to get from one to that, but the unity of the soul, the way the soul, the rational soul, is unifying our body. As I said, our intentionality goes all over the body. It is at the root of also our free choices. The reflexivity by which we can think about ourselves and reconsider who we want to be. If I reflect on myself, I step outside of myself to look at myself. There's a kind of self-transcendence in that. And no animal can do that. No animal can think about whether it wants to leave its ecological niche or something like that and become something else. No computer can do that. A thermostat is reflexive in the sense of a cybernetic feedback loop, but it has to obey its setting. Right? It cannot reset its setting. But we can think of our own setting, right, and who we have come to be and said, I really don't like who I am. Right? In extreme cases, people commit suicide. But in a positive sense, you can have a conversion. Right? And so there's a sense of freedom, and free will in a way is implied here that there's more to that. But there's an element of freedom, again, that opens up that, again, no computer can have. Computer cannot rewrite its source algorithm, its source code. Right? It cannot reflect on the code because it needs the code to reflect on anything. That is why computers, I want to suggest, cannot upgrade themselves. Why, now you can prove me wrong about that, but why no computer can build a computer better than itself. We can do that, but not the machines themselves. And it is because why I think, I mean, the computers are not necessarily taking over the world, at least in that way. There may be other ways. So reflexivity, I think, is an important thing to consider. It's not often thought about, but and we can talk about it more. But it has to do with even our sense of freedom and our sense of agency. Father James talked about agency. As something where we can start things new, be creative even. And so all of that, I think, we cannot make. We cannot, as I said, we cannot even make life. You know, a simple flower is more than your computer is because it's alive and it's unified by a soul, just as we are. And that is why only living things beget living things. We can only make artifacts that are not alive. So as long as we are not concerned about the life in a computer, as long as we are not concerned about immortal souls in a computer, as long as we are not worried about baptizing them for their salvation, I don't think we have any reason to think of intelligence here in any more than a metaphorical sense. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.